Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
It's the 28th day of January 2025. Hello and welcome to the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm Duduzile Ramela in for Jimmy Muyaha this evening. Here's what you can look forward to. As usual, we speak to our market watcher, and today we're joined by Chantel Marks, Head of Research at FNB Wealth and Investments. We also take a look at the update from the Airports Company of South Africa in terms of how they fared over the festive season, but honing in more so on the jet fuel shortages. Lyndon Burns is the founder of Plain Talking, and he will be talking to us about that quite shortly. And then we take a look at the Board of Healthcare Funders' application to have its members exempted from Section 4 of Chapter 2 of the Competition Act, which was a bid that was dismissed by the Competition Commission. They're going to be speaking to us, especially Katleho Muthudi, Managing Director of the Board of Healthcare Funders, in terms of the interview that we did yesterday with the Competition Commission, and replying to some of the assertions that were made by the Competition Commission yesterday. And then we speak about terms and conditions. Yes, those words that you always hear being said. Do you know what you can and cannot do with your credit or debit card, more so when it comes to international payments? Natalie Matthews is a payment specialist at NetBank, and she'll talk to us about that. We also take a look at university admissions. It's a crisis, it is said. We'll find out why. And then we'll take a look at the proposed fuel legislation, which is causing some headaches for farmers. And Elise Crosby is Head of Legal Intelligence at Agribiz, and she will tell us all about that.
The Market Update, Monday to Thursday, 6 to 7 p.m.
A market watcher this evening, Chantel Marks, Head of Research at FNB Wealth and Investments, is standing by to give us a sense of how we fared today. Chantel, thank you very much for your time. Good evening.
Good evening. Yes, it was actually a pretty decent day. I mean, at the start of the day, we saw red markets across the world, and there really was quite a bit of negativity out there. But the market seemed to push higher, and it was quite broad-based. I mean, with the exception of resources, most of the major sectors were positive on the day. We also saw the Rand actually hold up quite well relative to the US dollar, if you compare it to some of the other currencies out there. We had gold pushing up quite nicely, and yeah, I mean, I think generally just a much better day than what we anticipated at the start.
Yeah, you speak of gold pushing quite well, and all eyes are on the US Federal Reserve's policy meeting and gold holding firm. What do we put this down to?
Well, I do think that there's still a lot of risk out there. Gold generally tends to underperform when the rand, when the dollar is as strong as it is. But I think that there's a understanding that the risks are still quite high out there. I think when we look towards tomorrow's Fed meeting, all the focus will be there, but it won't. Well, most of the focus will be there, but there are also some other things to consider. I mean, we are in the midst of U.S. earnings season. We have major tech companies coming up with results this week, and you can argue that that's almost become macro events. Rather than just company-specific events.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a look at when I say the word DeepSeek, China's AI disruptor, it is said. What do we need to understand about that? Because you open the internet and that is what we are seeing.
Yes, so we saw a massive sell down in tech stocks in the US the day before, well, yesterday actually, overnight. Nvidia in itself down 16.9%. And I mean, prior to the drop, it was the most valuable company in the world. And what we need to understand about DeepSeek is that they've basically developed something that's very similar to ChatGPT, so it's a large language model, but they've done so at a much lower cost using older generation chips. And at a time when US tech stocks were quite expensive. So I think that this correction that we saw in Nvidia is to be expected given the launch of DeepSeek and the way that it competes with any US kind of AI story. But I do think that there was it did have to do with the valuation as well, because I don't think anyone should be surprised that the next large language model akin to ChatGPT will be developed at a lower cost because the technology is known now, or using older generation chips, because indeed ChatGPT was developed on older generation chips.
Let's take a look at oil while we on. Well, we discussed commodities in terms of gold, but what's happening with oil?
Yes, so the oil price actually pushed slightly higher today. It's still the oil price is still quite soft, and that is very good news from a South African perspective because we are oil importers, still trading below $80 a barrel because supply and demand dynamics are still a little bit out of sync. The expectation is that supply will still hold up quite well, and even though the demand outlook looks okay, I think there's still concern that you are going to see a continued kind of softness and growth from the likes of China, and you would require a step change there and perhaps a stronger recovery in Europe, for example, before you will see the oil price climb any higher.
So we've been observing what is happening with the government of national unity, and there seems to be some fractures from the outside looking in. Have the markets responded to this at all?
So it doesn't seem as if there's been a massive response around it. I mean, as I mentioned, even though the rand is slightly weaker today, it's still held up quite well relative to some of the other major currencies globally. By its nature, a government of national unity will have its ups and downs. And I think that the market recognizes this. I think there's a broader commitment to making it work. But we will see a lot of news reports and media flows when it comes to any sort of disagreements. And I think that we would have expected that at the start, and I don't think it's going to go away anytime soon.
Speaking of expectations, Thursday is around the corner. What's your expectation from the South African Reserve Bank?
So our expectation is that the Reserve Bank will be able to cut rates by 25 basis points, and hopefully they will actually push that through, because inflation in South Africa has actually been keeping in check quite well. We are now at a point where inflation is still at the lower end of the SARB stated target band, which is 3-6%. The midpoint is 4.5%. And even if you look at inflation expectations over the next year, it's expected to move up to about 4.5%. So we think that the South African Reserve Bank has room, and hopefully we get that cut.
So South Africa is looking to break coal line dependence on Chinese spares. How do we need to understand this development?
So I think that when you're looking at any sort of dependent situation, when you're very dependent on a specific market or a specific company for anything, put forward quite a large risk. So I think it's a risk mitigation story, and I don't think we should read anything outside of risk mitigation into it.
Okay. Woolworths is warning of earnings not doing so well, as the apparel division is also not doing so well. What do we need to understand, or rather, what are you looking forward to there?
Yes, so when we look at Woolworths' trading statement and operational update that they put forward, there was a slight difference in calendar dates that they were looking at specifically. So you had a few less trading days, and the food division did exceptionally well. It was market outperforming. We also had an update from ShopRite today, and Woolworths actually outperformed Checkers. So it does seem as if they're doing quite well still in the food business. In fashion and beauty and home in South Africa, you've got the beauty business doing very well, but I think that they're probably overstocked in the South African market, and they did cite that they had some supply chain challenges, so they had problems getting stock into store. So from a fashion perspective, I would expect a lot of emphasis to be on them fixing that business, because it still remains quite weak. And then on the Australian side, the Country Road Group was in every single David Jones store there, and when Woolworths sold David Jones, they actually started trading as a standalone business again, which means that their cost base is way too high, and that they have to reconfigure the way that they sell their apparel in the Australian market. And I think that we'll probably continue to see that being an issue for them, at least for the next 6 to 12 months.
Okay, so in the South African market, it doesn't necessarily speak to oppressed consumer, because beauty is doing well.
Beauty is doing well, and food is doing well. Very expensive food, I must add.
Chantal, thank you very much, as always, for your time. Chantal Marks, Head of Research at FNB Wealth and Investments.
The Market Update, Monday to Thursday, 6 to 7 p.m.
Investors want real returns that beat inflation and help them achieve their long-term goals. To do this successfully, one needs to strike the appropriate balance between risk and return. Join SAFM Market Update tomorrow evening at 6:45 as Allan Gray Portfolio Manager Sean Munsey joins the show. He will explain how the firm is thinking about the current risks in the environment and positioning client portfolios for long-term returns. Brought to you by Allan Gray, more than 50 years of long-term investing. Allan Gray is an authorized FSP.
The Market Update, Monday to Thursday, 6 to 7 p.m.
All right, let's take a look at this now. The Airports Company of South Africa today gave an update on how the state-owned entity performed during the festive season, including but not limited to infrastructure challenges like jet fuel shortages. We speak to Lyndon Burns, founder of Plane Talking, about this. Lyndon, good evening. Before we get into it, let's just take a listen to what we heard today earlier from AXA CEO Mpumi Mpofu.
AXA is healthy. It's a going concern. It is operating well. AXA has recovered. We've had a successful peak season. We are about to roll out an extensive capital program that will see the condition of our airports restored to A grade.
Lyndon Burns, founder of Plane Talking, your overall impression of today's update in terms of the tone?
Hi, Didi, and to everyone who's listening, good evening. Look, I think two things there. AXA at the moment are positioning ahead of the next round of tariff increase, or its next application for a tariff increase to the regulator. And obviously, industry is concerned that any increases, you know, should be reflect the level of service that is provided. And there is presumably going to be some tough discussion around that. And then, of course, we've got to, you know, match that with what we've seen, the operational failures recently, you know, December with the fuel valve system having failed at our Tambo. Then we saw the power system at Cape Town that powers the refueling system, but that went on, you know, that broke down last week, and the backup generators failed as well. And throughout this, we've also had the situation where jet fuel supplies have been a matter of concern now for about 4 years. And a lot of this goes back to, first of all, the insurrection and the damage that was caused at the refineries in Durban at the time, back in 2021, as well as the subsequent floods which damaged the rail infrastructure and now, more recently, the fire at Natref. And the way fuel is distributed in the country and because those refineries are down, we rely very heavily on imported jet fuel. And that fuel has to be shipped or transported from the harbors up to Natref, and from there it goes into a dedicated pipeline to the fuel farm, the fuel depot at R. Tambo. Now, the one thing that does worry me is that AXA, you know, speaks a lot about having secured sufficient fuel, but AXA doesn't own the fuel. Hmm. AXA owns the storage infrastructure and the refueling infrastructure, the equipment. The fuel is owned by fuel supplier companies. They just store it at AXA. And they are being very opaque at the moment in terms of how much fuel they currently own. We know that at the airport, the facility is currently storing about 4 days worth of fuel.
Sure.
The current requirement for fuel is only about 3 to 4 million liters a day at R. Tambo. Now, if we compare that with pre-COVID, that's reduced greatly, because at the time it was around 11 million liters a day. And the difference can be attributed primarily to SAA not operating many of its long-haul operations anymore. And they made up for about 40% of the total fuel consumption. As well as Mango no longer being in the market, SA Express no longer being in the market, Kalula and the British Airways domestic regional brand no longer being here. Of course, there's been some pickup of the slack with Fly Safair with Airlink expanding as well, and Semir, and then Lyft coming in as a rather small player though. But it does speak to, you know, and there is concern. And I know, you know, speaking to the Airlines Association of Southern Africa this afternoon, they are watching the situation closely and with concern, because again, although Natref have said 21 February is the date by which they should be up and running again and having repaired all the damage after the fire last month, we haven't received an update from them on how that work is progressing. And similarly, the shipments of fuel rely on ships and weather conditions at the harbors as well. So we'll have to wait and see. We're not counting any chickens until that fuel actually arrives in the storage depot. There is also some concern about the fuel situation at Cape Town. There was a recent consignment of fuel that actually had to be rejected because it didn't pass the quality control tests that all the fuel has to go through. So at Cape Town, fuel at the moment is around about 3 days of reserve stock. It's enough to keep us going. It should be enough to ensure that, and if those individual fuel suppliers have reached agreements with the individual airlines they contracted to supply to, there should be enough for everybody. But we're still seeing some airlines, like Lufthansa, which has been rerouting flights via Durban and Windhoek to refuel there, which tells us that not everything is yet resolved with the different fuel companies.
Sure. Yeah, Lyndon, because I think a note to you and to our listeners as well, we've been trying to get hold of any representative from AXA, but unfortunately, by the time we went on air, we were not able to secure anyone. But let's just break down some of the concerns, right? So when it comes to the jet fuel supplies, you say we import jet fuel and there are fuel supplier companies. Where do we import this jet fuel from?
So it's about 80% of our fuel gets imported at the moment. There's a smaller portion that gets produced by the Astron refinery in Cape Town, but then they only just came back online last year, and they're still ramping up to full production. But even so, they only account for a small, you know, relatively small component of jet fuel, and only for Cape Town. So we're getting our fuel internationally, or you know, from various markets. It is a refined product. And it comes in as that. I'm not 100% sure of the exact provenance and source markets of those fuel. You know, it's ordered through the fuel suppliers and then sent and positioned at the AXA fuel depots at OR Tambo, at King Shaka, at Cape Town International, all of the other AXA airports. But, you know, the fuel situation and the concerns around that and the infrastructure failures that we've seen recently speak to a bigger, broader story of concern, which is around the state of our aviation infrastructure services. We're still struggling with the air traffic navigation service, which withdrew over 300 instrument flight procedures for airports around the country. And anyone who's tried to travel to or from George by air yesterday or today will be painfully aware of the situation. Because of the direction in which the wind is blowing, flights are required to land in a particular direction on runway 11. And the instrument flight procedure for approaching that airport was withdrawn, was one of those 300 that was withdrawn because the ATNS hadn't been doing their work over the last 12 years in terms of maintaining the approvals of those systems. They're meant to review each procedure every 5 years. Now, this is a procedure is a set of instructions plus a schematic diagram that pilots follow when they have to descend from cruising altitude to then land at a particular airport on a particular runway in a specific direction. Okay. And similarly, when they take off. Now, without those, operations get disrupted, and they've been disrupted across the country since last July. In addition to that, we've had the weather service, the SA Weather Service, which got hacked. Its IT system was hacked twice on the weekend. It's still offline, and they're responsible for providing all of the essential weather observation and forecast services for aviation and marine operations around South Africa and our harbors and airports.
Sure.
It's actually illegal to take off without getting a weather forecast.
Hmm. This is so big and we have such little time, but in the interest of a listener who's saying, okay, two things, long term, what then needs to be done, because you've outlined that the bigger story here or the real problem is the state of aviation infrastructure services. Should I even book a ticket to go anywhere at this particular point in time? Will it be worth my money, or will I get a notice in 3-4 days' time to say, hey, sorry, we'll reimburse you, or you can take another flight whenever?
Yeah, well, first of all, these types of infrastructure failures are beyond the control of the airlines. So, the airlines are not going to be on the hook there for compensation. They don't manage the fuel supplies, and they don't manage the air traffic navigation service. We all pay, and the airlines pay, we all pay user charges. And what I was talking about at the beginning of the interview, AXA and AT&S and the weather services are all gearing up and preparing to submit their requests for tariff increases to their respective regulators. And that's going to hit us all in the pocket. I don't think there's a risk right now of flights being cancelled. You may find that some flights are going to be delayed, not necessarily because of the fuel situation, but certainly with AT&S's problems that they're having. And what it requires really is for, first of all, the Minister of Transport and these different agencies report to the Department of Transport, so AXA, AT&S, to first of all acknowledge that there actually is a crisis here. And really put some effort into resolving them. The Civil Aviation Authority is the oversight body, but it can get together with AXA and AT&S and make sure that, you know, they have systems in place so that they're all talking to each other. The CAA, for example, can say to the Air Traffic Navigation Service, when you submit the paperwork for reapproval of those procedures, this is the format we need it in. Okay. This is the format we need the surveys in. Instead, what we're seeing is that the stuff gets submitted and then it gets rejected because the CAA is not happy with the quality of work being done.
Hmm. Lyndon, thank you very much for your contribution this evening. Lyndon Burns, founder of Plain Talking.
The Market Update, Monday to Thursday, 6 to 7 p.m.
So on the show last night, you'll remember we spoke to the Competition Commission's Mapato Ramokgoba, Divisional Manager of Market Conduct, on its decision to reject the Board of Healthcare Funders' application to have its members exempt from Section 4 of Chapter 2 of the Competition Act, an instrument that prohibits agreements between competitors that lessen or prevent competition in a market. And this evening, we get to speak to the BHF to get their side of the story. And thank you to Katlego Mthudi, Managing Director of the Board of Healthcare Funders, for bringing this to our attention, because there is some clarity that you would like to bring to light. Thank you so much, Mr. Mthudi. Please go for it.
Hi, Dudu. How are you?
Well, and you, sir?
I'm all right.
Thank you.
I think it's unfortunate that the Competition Commission, after 3 years of waiting, decided not to grant our application. Surprising, because our application was on the back of their own recommendation following the Health Market Inquiry report, which, among other things, indicated that there was a need for price regulation, which was transparent. We were concerned that the report was released in 2019, and a number of recommendations came out, but both the Department of Health as well as the Council for Medical Teams have to date not implemented a single one. While we see the sustainability of the medical aid being put at risk. So we sent in an application 3 years ago, as I said, and asked them to allow us to start negotiating on behalf of our members. We are surprised that they're saying that that will have an impact of tilting the market. And the fact is, the market is already tilted, and this is also according to their report. It is not fair on the small entities, because the big schemes are able to negotiate fair pricing for their members, because they've got good spend, etc. but the smaller entities do not enjoy those privileges. And we thought that with the escalating prices and cost of private health care, they would have jumped at the opportunity to allow us to do that.
So essentially what's good for the goose in this case is not good for the gander. So what options are then available to you, if at all?
We have the opportunity of appealing to the Competition Commission Tribunal. We've got 20 days to study this and then do the submission, which is exactly what you are going to do.
Okay, so you'll definitely be appealing this, because when we spoke to the Competition Commission yesterday, we also put it to them that in terms of their findings, what did they find when it comes to the consumer, right? So a person who would have medical aid, and what their considerations were. And they said, well, we were considering people with medical aid, but you've also got people with medical aid that are in the not so bigger scheme. So how should we understand that, or how do you understand that?
Yeah, it doesn't make sense. I mean, I listened to the comment about them saying that the industry is not at risk. You would have to see this year that most of the schemes have got about above 10% increases for their contributors. Mm. It's not indicative of a market that is stable. And I think it's disingenuous for the commission to say that there is stability. This was actually brought on by the National Department of Health in 2014 already, to saying that the increases are unknown. So the barriers to entry have been increasing, and a lot of people are actually finding it difficult to belong to medical aid scheme because of the increase yearly that are quite astronomical.
Thank you so much, sir, for the clarity and letting us know that you definitely will be taking this on appeal. So we'll be keeping a very keen eye on developments where this is concerned. Katlego Muthudi is the Managing Director of the Board of Healthcare Funders.
The Market Update, Monday to Thursday, 6 to 7 p.m.
Terms and conditions apply. You will have heard these words time and again on your radio, television, and if you are want to go through the fine print, read it on agreements you enter into. Nedbank is no different. It has recently issued a note to customers stating that all credit, debit, and virtual cards issued in South Africa have certain regulatory limitations and or obligations when making international payments, and following the rules is non-negotiable. Failure to comply could result in fines and or withholding of funds by the South African Reserve Bank, as well as the South African Revenue Service imposing further penalties. Natalie Matthews is payment specialist at Nedbank and is standing by. Natalie, good evening, to tell us about what you observed that prompted this move to sort of make your customers aware about these regulations.
Good evening, Dudu. Thanks for the invitation to chat to you. So we have been issuing the communication to all of our cardholders to remind them of the SOB regulations that are applicable to the use of credit, debit, and virtual cards, particularly when it comes to international or cross-border transactions or payments. And we're doing this really to, as I said, to remind them what the rules are. It is up to every cardholder to understand what the regulations are and to be compliant with them. At Nedbank, our purpose is to use our financial expertise to do good. And part of doing good is to assist our customers and our clients to understand what the regulations are.
Let's get into some of the rules, right? Let's start, because you've got four specific rules that you want people to be aware of. South Africa, with the way things are set up, a lot of people are taking on to online gambling, but there's something that they need to know. What is it about gambling?
Indeed. As you say, there are four points that we covered in the communication, and all of those points come from the central bank's regulations, which are stipulated in the SARB's Currency and Exchanges Manual for Authorized Dealers. Now, an authorized dealer is a bank which is authorized by the Financial Surveillance Department at the SARB to deal in foreign exchange for transactions relating to foreign exchange. So the rule that you're referring to is related to online lotteries, gambling, or sports betting activities with providers that are outside of South Africa. The rule says you may not use your South African issued debit, credit, or virtual card to take part in these activities. And if you do, as a cardholder, we as Nedbank or your bank, if you bank with somebody else, may be instructed by the SARB to confiscate the winnings and pay them over to the Gambling Board of South Africa.
Very important to note that. Let's take a look at the second rule. Transactions are limited, especially foreign transactions. Why? What do people need to know about that?
All right. So there are two rules which talk to what you're speaking about. The one says that there is a restriction of 50,000 Rand for online card payments for imports, subscriptions, or services. These card payments for imports, subscriptions, and services may not exceed 50,000 Rand each. This does exclude foreign travel-related card payments. The regulation also says that you can't split a payment that is over 50,000 Rand into smaller transactions to avoid the rule, and also that you would need to comply with any applicable import duties and customs requirements. So it's important to remember, Didi, that even though a foreign website might accept a card payment which exceeds 50,000 Rand, this payment is not allowed according to the SARB's regulations. All right. The other rule that is related is talking to the single discretionary allowance. Mm-hmm. So a single discretionary allowance, or an SDA, with a limit of 1 million Rand per calendar year is available to all South African residents who are 18 years and older. And the point that we were reminding our customers of and the public of was that all foreign transactions count towards your single discretionary allowance. And that includes card payments or cash withdrawals while you are overseas, as well as purchases on international e-commerce sites. And that is obviously in addition to any money that you might have transferred offshore via SWIFT payments for the purposes of investing abroad. So the communication was reminding our clients to make sure that they don't exceed that 1 million Rand annual limit.
Ah, and funding of foreign currency accounts is not allowed.
Well, it is allowed. So okay. let's define the distinction. Okay. So funding of foreign currency accounts, whether local or abroad, may not be done via card payments. Okay. So only SWIFT payments or cross-border transfers are permitted for the purposes of funding a foreign currency account. And that rule also extends to the funding of international trading, investments, and crypto wallets or accounts. So if you need to fund an account like that, you would need to refer that to an authorized dealer or your bank to process within the prescribed rules. And again, you would make use of a foreign or an international EFT or a SWIFT payment. So the SARB is not saying you may not have those accounts or you may not fund them. It's just saying that you may not use your locally issued credit, debit, or virtual card for that purpose. And again, I would say that those international organizations that you may have these accounts with, they may provide the facility to accept a card payment, and they may accept your South African card payment, but the onus is on the cardholder to understand and be aware that you're not actually allowed to use your card for those purposes according to South African regulation.
Okay. As we were preparing for the interview, the producer of the show, Kaldora Naidu, asked a very important question, because now you've got younger people that have bank accounts, right? And so do the rules, how do you navigate that where a young person who may not, how do I even ask this question? Do they read the rules and regulations? Do they read the terms and conditions? Would they be aware? Do these rules also apply to that younger market?
Yes, so the rules apply to all South African citizens, and the rules are not new. They, as I say, are governed and are part of the regulations set out by the SARB, and can be read on the SARB's website. They actually have a very useful and easy to navigate website, and it also has guidelines for individuals and also for business entities to help them understand these rules. And they also have a very useful set of FAQs, or frequently asked questions, which can help guide people. So yes, the answer to the question is the rules do apply to everybody. And again, the onus is on the individual to understand these rules. So that is why we periodically do communicate these rules. It might go through on additional notes, let's say on your statement, and periodically we will send out communications such as the one that we're discussing. And I would encourage people to make sure that they read those communications, because they do contain important information, and it's important to be able to assist you to comply with the law.
Absolutely. Natalie, thank you very much. That was fascinating. Yeah, some of the things I wasn't even aware of. So now we know. Thank you very much, Natalie Matthews, payment specialist at Nedbank.
Affordable data is more than just a convenience, it's a real catalyst for change. In the latest Fix SA episode, I talked to George Mendes, who's the Chief Executive Officer of Cell C, about the telco industry's role in driving inclusive economic growth. From empowering underserved communities to fostering entrepreneurship, connectivity is unlocking potential and creating opportunities. Join me, Jeremy Maggs, and South Africa's top leaders on the fortnightly MoneyWeb Fix SA podcast. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
The Market Update, Monday to Thursday, 6 to 7 p.m.
This interview is brought to you by Eduvos. As we speak, there are frustrated parents and students who've been journeying to and from institutions of higher learning seeking admission to no avail. That's because of the 337,158 students who qualified for university. Only some 200,000 will get space, leaving more than 100,000 students in the lurch. We have heard it being said that the demand for higher education study in 2025 has been the highest in history, and maybe these figures speak to that. Private institutions and are looking to close the gap with their offerings. Eduvos is one of those institutions. We speak to Director of Operations of the NetEd Group, Dr. Rianne Steenberg, on their efforts to place students in need. And I guess, Doc, overall, to maybe ask the question as we kick off the conversation whether we have a crisis here. Good evening.
Thank you, Dudu. I think the South African public higher education system is facing a significant issue, but it's important to recognize that the crisis is as much about perception and preference as it is about numbers. While public universities are oversubscribed, there's capacity in the private sector to accommodate at least 60 to 70,000 new students. And institutions like Eduvos also offer online hybrid options that significantly increase flexibility, enabling students to study from anywhere in the country while accessing the same high quality education than those that are seeking to gain access to public campuses. And in some cases, it is even better. So I think we need to start thinking differently about the outcomes of education and ask, what are we trying to do here? And it is really to create the labor of the future. And private institutions need to be viewed as essential partners, not as alternatives. Eduvos brings additional capacity and offers flexibility that public institutions sometimes cannot. We have programs that cater to various levels, including those who may not meet traditional university admission requirements. For example, we offer higher certificates, bridging programs, which are ideal for students who need to be stepping stone before pursuing a degree and that may not even have had university exemption. We also do a lot of work in recognition of prior learning, so that many people that have gained work experience or informal training can use RPL to gain access to higher education, opening doors that might otherwise remain closed. So I think by combining public and private resources, we can ensure that every qualifying student, and even those who don't yet qualify, has access to education and the opportunity to succeed.
When you speak of perceptions, Doc, how do we balance access with differentiation? What drives choice architecture for incoming students? And some students and parents right now, when you mention private institutions versus public, because in public you can go to what, NASFIS? I'm not sure if that's the case also for private institutions. Please do forgive my ignorance, but pricing. Some people are worried about pricing.
And that's a very important point, Dudu. There's a common perception that private institutions are unaffordable or exclusive, but in reality, this isn't the case. Institutions like Eduvos offer various flexible payment plans, financial aid, scholarships, and we make education more accessible. Additionally, our higher certificates provide a quicker, more affordable route into the workforce for students who may not want to commit to a 3 or 4 year program immediately. What sets private institutions apart is our agility. At Eduvos, we focus on career-driven education, with programs aligned to emerging industries like technology, business, biomedicine, data science, and AI, and law. Students don't just gain theoretical knowledge. They also acquire practical work-ready skills through internships, project-based learning, and industry partnerships. Furthermore, we offer multiple study modes, like full-time, part-time, online, hybrid options. This ensures that wherever you are, if you're a working professional, a young student, or someone returning to studies after a break, there is an option that suits your lifestyle. By working collaboratively with governments and funding bodies, we can also help ease the financial burden on public universities while expanding access to education for all South Africans. You also asked a very important question to say, is NSFAS the only way that it is? And I think, indeed, funding is one of the greatest challenges facing higher education. NSFAS plays a vital role in supporting students from disadvantaged backgrounds, but the demand has far outstripped what the current funding model for publics can sustain. Right now, there's more than $20 billion in unpaid student debt owed to NSFAS, and it's clear that's not a sustainable model in the long term. We at EduBus have been working very hard with industry and funding partners to provide innovative financing options such as partial bursaries, corporate sponsorships, income share agreements, payment plans. These solutions reduce the financial burden on both students and the government while ensuring more students have access to education. We also offer programs that are shorter and that can be done in part-time study options that enable students to enter the workforce more quickly while continuing to upskill over time. So initially, these modes of delivery allow students to learn from everywhere, saving on living and travel expenses. So we really need to think about how we utilize limited resources to embrace collaboration, to create a system that's both accessible and sustainable, and that serves the needs of those students to find employment. We also encourage the government to explore funding models that prioritize critical skills areas like engineering, healthcare, and agriculture to address national priorities and grow the economy.
Doc, when you hear the acronym PPPs, you think of maybe the electricity or energy sector, right? Public-private partnerships, because it's been emphasized so much in that sector. But when you speak of us thinking differently for the future and collaboration between public and private institutions of higher learning, how important are public-private partnerships? How do you envisage it would work, right, for the future to accommodate students who are still coming in to the system?
Absolutely. And thanks for the question, Dudu. I think really effective public-private partnerships are about leveraging the strengths of both sectors and to create a robust and inclusive higher education system that serves the needs of the country. For example, we can do shared research initiatives between public and private institutions that can advance knowledge in areas like technology, medicine, renewable energy. At EduBus, we also believe in joint programs where students can start their studies at a public institution and complete specialized modules through private institutions. This approach not only expands capacity, but also enhances the quality of education by pooling resources and expertise. Another area of collaboration is specialized training academies. These can be jointly funded and operated by public and private partners focused on critical skills needed in South Africa, such as healthcare, engineering, data analytics. And this type of model will reduce the strain on public institutions while ensuring students receive the best possible training for the workforce. I think education has become a purpose unto itself, and I think we really need to take a step back and say, why are we here and how can we really make this work?
Doc, what is your advice to students and parents who are now really hard-pressed to find space?
If you did not gain entry, really don't panic. And don't feel like you're out of options. At EduBus, we are here to support you and ensure you find the right path and way forward. We understand how overwhelming this time can be, but we have multiple ways to help you get started. Firstly, we're still accepting applications and walk-in registrations across all of our campuses across the country. You can come in, speak to our advisors, and explore your options in person. If you didn't qualify for a traditional degree program, we offer higher certificates and bridging programs that can serve as a stepping stone into further studies or even the workforce. These programs are specifically designed to help students who might need a bit more support to achieve their academic and career goals. And for those of you that need flexibility, we have part-time and online study options that allow you to work while you study or learn from the comfort of your home. We also have 4 intakes in the year, so if you don't make it in this first intake, you can get into the second, third, or fourth intakes throughout the year. Every program at EduBus is available in hybrid or campus-based formats, so you can choose the mode of study that best suits your lifestyle. So whether you're looking to start a degree, enter the workforce quickly through a higher certificate or upskill while working, EduBus has a solution for you, and we invite you to visit our website, and then we can really avert this crisis. Thank you, Dudu.
That's www.eduvos.com. Thank you so much, Doc, for your time this evening. And that was Director of Operations of the NetEd Group, Dr. Rian Steenberg. This interview was brought to you by EduVos, your education, your future.
EduVos applications are still open for 2025. Step into a brighter future with South Africa's leading private higher education institution. With over 20 accredited qualifications, internationally recognized, flexible study options, and 12 campuses nationwide, EduVos prepares you for the careers of tomorrow. Study on campus, online, or distance. Your future starts at EduVos. Visit eduvos.com and enroll today. Eduvos, your education, your future.
My name is Frank Leonet, CEO and founder of South Africa's newest crypto exchange called Afridex. I will be on the MoneyWeb crypto podcast with Kieran Ryan to explain why we believe South Africa could benefit from a new crypto exchange and how we differ from the existing exchanges. Join us this week to find out more.
Don't forget, join me, Kieran Ryan, weekly on the MoneyWeb crypto podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
The Market Update, Monday to Thursday, 6 to 7 p.m.
So in October of 2024, the Department of Mineral Resources and Energy published the Draft Petroleum Products Bill for public comment. Now, the purpose of the bill, it said at the time, was to ensure the security of petroleum products and to introduce modern and environmentally friendly components that will improve South Africa's energy mix. And according to the bill, all consumers who store petroleum products for their own use, such as farmers, must have an end user certificate. And one of the provisions of the bill is that end users will have to provide financial guarantees in the form of insurance, a bank guarantee, or cash. The proposed new legislation requires every fuel storage point on a farm to have a certificate and also seek to limit fuel sellers such as agricultural businesses. Now, the Agricultural Business Chamber, or Agribiz, has expressed concern over the bill. Annelise Crosby is Agribiz Head of Legal Intelligence, and she joins us, Annelise, this evening to give us some context. What is it that farmers are doing, and what is it that the bill is seeking to introduce? Thank you very much for your time.
You're very welcome. So, you know, I think one acknowledges that there is probably a need for a new bill. There's one in existence currently, but it dates from 1977. I think, you know, one also needs to acknowledge that regulation in the petroleum industry is necessary. But the extent to which this bill goes in its regulation, we think is going to cause problems in practice, not just for farmers, producers on the farm, but also for the whole of the agricultural value chain. So if we can start with the end consumer facility certificates, this is completely new. Mm-hmm. So in the current legislation, there's already a controller, there's already a requirement for licenses, but this certificate is a new thing. So what is required is that anybody who stores or uses petroleum, and the definition of petroleum is very broad, so it's petrol, diesel, paraffin, all sorts of biodiesel, everything included, for their own use in bulk, will have to apply for such an end facility certificate. And our estimation is there are well over 100,000 of these facilities probably, and it seems that each and every such an end user facility will probably require a certificate. So just the, you know, the process of applying and for these controllers to go through all the applications and then allocate the certificates, we foresee is going to be very problematic. Hmm. Also, I don't think many farmers are aware of this requirement at this point in time. It's never been required before. So you're going to need a huge communication campaign, information campaign, just to get everybody to know about this requirement. And then, you know, of course, there are very high penalties that will apply if an inspector comes to your farm and you are required to have an end user certificate and you can't produce that end user certificate. I mean, they're talking of fines in the region of 50,000 rand per day for such a contravention of the legislation.
If you please would allow this very simple question, why do farmers store fuel on their property?
Okay, so lots of farmers have tractors, they have harvesters, all sorts of machinery generators that use a lot of fuel. So they have to buy fuel in bulk in order to run all of those farming machines.
Ah, got you. Thank you very much. So when you speak of some of these headaches, right, for farmers and what farmers are unaware of, this bill is also looking to give inspectors broad powers. What are some of those broad powers that will then be given to these inspectors?
Yeah, so it seems that the inspectors will be able to come onto facilities without prior notice and require all sorts of documentation and so on. And that can, of course, disrupt a business such as a retail fuel facility. And then also, if there is a suspicion that particular facility is contravening one of the so-called prohibitive actions that the bill, and there's a long list of those that are in the bill, then they may even go as far as closing that facility. So the powers are very broad.
Mm. We understand, according to Agribiz, that this bill is already overstepping on what is on the current legislation, because it could impose demanding conditions on any license holder, including requirements for management, control, ownership, sustainability, supporting culture and fair employment, which are already there. How should we understand this?
Yes, so the licenses, it seems, will be subject to three kinds of conditions. One of these is environmental conditions that can be imposed. Then there are transformation conditions that can be imposed. And then there are so-called efficiency considerations as well. And in terms of transformation and the protection of the environment, there is existing legislation. We have the BE legislation that regulates transformation in all sectors of the economy. And we also have the National Environment Management Act that deals with the environmental considerations. So we are concerned about the duplication of some of those provisions in this legislation and the confusion that will cause in terms of, you know, who's then responsible for enforcing it.
From your engagement, because you mentioned a little bit earlier on that you do not think that farmers or some farmers are aware of this bill even, so a massive communication campaign will have to get underway. From those you have spoken to, what's been the temperature?
I think mostly the producers are surprised at this point in time that there is such a requirement that is coming. I think the majority are completely unaware of this. And concerned, of course, because it's going to place an additional administrative burden on them, and an additional administrative burden also means financial implications for their businesses as well.
Storage facilities cannot be moved, hey, and you've already got the Department of Labor which visits farms. Is there a friction point here? Should maybe this then be just given to the Department of Labor to do?
No, because it doesn't have anything to do with okay. Labour legislation okay. at all.
All right. Thank you so much for helping us understand that. And so maybe just in closing up the conversation, how did the consultation process go? What happens now?
Yeah, so luckily the consultation process is still ongoing. So there would be further opportunities. The department indicated at the last meeting that they would now take all the inputs into consideration that they have received at a previous consultative meeting, and they would give feedback on that. So that is the next step. They have also said that they are open to bilateral engagements with specific sectors who request that. And thereafter, you know, there will be a NEDLAC process okay. where all four of the NEDLAC constituencies will then also engage on the bill and go through the bill clause by clause. And only thereafter will we have the parliamentary process where, once again, there will be opportunity for written submissions and hopefully oral presentations to the parliamentary committee as well.
So this could only be years in the making if it goes through, right? If it goes through.
Yeah, it is quite a lengthy process.
Yeah. Thank you so much for your time this evening. We really appreciate it. And that is Agribiz Head of Legal, Annelise Crosby. Thank you very much for tuning into the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. Plenty to come for you tomorrow as well. If you missed any of our conversations, you can head on over to our website. That's www.moneyweb.co.za. Have yourselves a magic evening further. Bahayachu, bulakio.